Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. This week we celebrate Veterans Day. To mark the event, we'll be looking at the history of some of America's best-loved patriotic songs with the author of a new book on the subject, Ace Collins. We'll also be hearing from Alan Winkler, a regular on this show, who in our commentary of the week will give us his thoughts on the American Empire. And for our site of the week, Talking History's Fiona Beattie will tell us about a new museum exhibit on Paul Revere's ride. But first, let's look at a few items of historical interest in the news on our military theme of the week. Manfred von Richthofen, the German military pilot better known as the Red Baron, met his demise in 1918 while pursuing a British plane over Allied territory, even after he and his airplane had been hit by enemy fire. This violated a principle of flying he himself had written, never place yourself at risk, obstinately staying with an escaping opponent. So why did he do it? Two medical researchers believe they now know why. Thomas Hyatt, a neuropsychologist at the Veterans Administration Medical Center in Cincinnati, and Daniel Orm, a clinical professor of health psychology at the University of Missouri, Columbia, believe that the misjudgment was due to a head injury the Red Baron suffered 10 months earlier when a British machine gun bullet splintered his skull. That severe injury, they suggest, although healed sufficiently to allow him to fly again, continued to impair his brain functions, which ultimately impacted his behavior, leading to his death. Historians in Thomasville, North Carolina, lay claim to having the only burial ground in the United States where Confederate and Union soldiers were put to rest side by side. It's only a small grass plot in the middle of the city's much larger cemetery, but it is the pride of local residents. Thomasville was only 13 years old in 1865 when it opened a hospital to treat wounded Confederate soldiers retreating south. But in the few months of the hospital's existence, it took in Union casualties as well, and in what historians agree was highly unusual, buried those who did not survive from both sides, 30 in all, in the cemetery. And also on the subject of military burials in preparation for Veterans Day, a number of recent news accounts have offered some history on the 24-note burial song known as Taps. In brief, Union General Daniel Butterfield and his brigade bugler, Oliver Norton, revised an existing bugle call known as Tattoo and used it to help command his brigade. It was quickly adopted by several other Confederate units to signal the end of the day. The word taps coming from the three drum taps beaten at night to signal lights out. The song was played for the first time at a funeral in 1862 during the Peninsular Campaign in Virginia. Captain John Tidball ordered it played rather than the traditional firing of three rifle volleys because he feared that the louder rifle salute would give away his position to nearby enemy troops. When we return, we take a look at the history of some other American songs. This is Talking History.
Father and I went down to camp along with Captain Gordon, and there we saw a man and boys as thick as hasty pudding. Yankee Doodle, keep it up, Yankee Doodle dandy. Mind the music and the step, and with the girls be handy.
From Yankee Doodle to the Star Spangled Banner and beyond, Americans have created a long list of patriotic songs for nearly every public occasion. Our guest this week, Ace Collins, has researched the history of those songs and shared what he found with Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
American history has a soundtrack. It includes songs like Yankee Doodle, The Star Spangled Banner, When Johnny Comes Marching Home, God Bless America, and much, much more. But while the music is familiar to all Americans, the often fascinating origins of the songs, where did they come from, who wrote them, are less well known. My guest Ace Collins is here to help us out. He's the author of Songs Sung Red, White, and Blue, the stories behind America's best-loved patriotic songs. Mr. Collins, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
The earliest song you talk about in your book is Yankee Doodle, which appears to be nonsense on the surface, but among other things, it's the reason Americans are called Yankees. What's the origin of that song?
Yeah, the song really goes back to England during the Oliver Cromwell period. The Puritan groups were made fun of a great deal. I mean, they were really ridiculed, and anyone who would be a Puritan was looked upon as being somewhat simple-minded, and there were two words that were used in a little ditty they would sing about Puritans, and it was called Yankee Doodle. And Yankee and Doodle both meant simple-minded. So you can imagine using both of those words together doubly magnified the simple-mindedness of these people. Well, the Puritans, to escape the persecution in England, came to the United States. And when they came to the United States, they were expecting to escape also that song, I'm sure. But the British came over not long after, a lot of aristocrats, a lot of the regular British people, and they started calling the American Puritans Yankee Doodles as well. Well, that changed because the New England Native Americans pronounced the word English for some reason as Yankee. And when it was pronounced as Yankee, the British at the time seized that, looked at the Puritans, and referred to American Puritans as Yankee Doodles. Well, that went on for a while, and it probably would have eventually been forgotten about because the ridicule of Puritans kind of evaporated over time in America. But something happened, and that was the French Indian War, and the English and the Americans fought together, and the English were these spit-shined, wonderful, red-coated soldiers. And the Americans were a ragtag group of farmers. They carried their own guns. A lot of them were wearing moccasins. They were wearing old ragged clothes. And a British doctor rewrote the song that ridiculed the Puritans and made it into a song that ridiculed the American troops and referred to them as Yankee Doodles. And wherever these poor troops marched during the French Indian War, they were serenaded by the British with this song. They grew to hate it. During the Revolutionary War, the song came back when the British came back over here to fight us. And the Americans again hated it. When they finally beat the British, they thought the song would go away forever. But George Washington had something different in mind. He brought his fife and bugle corps out, and when Cornwallis walked in, marched in to surrender to the American forces, Washington had his band play Yankee Doodle. I guess it was kind of like the in-the-face attitude you see a lot of athletes today as they get on the court, kind of a taunting kind of thing. And in that particular moment, that one playing of the song turned it from being a song of ridicule that for a couple of hundred years people would be trying to escape and bury forever into a song of national pride for America. And really, it became our first patriotic song.
One of the best loved songs, of course, is America, or My Country, 'Tis of Thee, which also, I thought, had English origins in the tune of God Save the King. But interestingly, you write in your book, Samuel Smith, who wrote the words, took umbrage when people accused him of using an English tune. He thought he'd written words to, what was it, God Bless Saxony? He thought it was a German tune.
He thought it was a German tune. Samuel Francis Smith was a seminary student. As a matter of fact, he had gone to Harvard with Oliver Wendell Holmes, who thought that Smith was quite a bright young man. And Smith was working in the seminary, going to school, and William Woolbridge, who had just returned from a trip to Germany, was very, very impressed with the German music and thought some of it could be adapted for use in America. So he brought back probably a dozen or more German hymnals, gave them to the great singer of the time, a songwriter, a hymn writer named Lowell Mason. Mason looked at them and couldn't read German and didn't care, and so he passed them on to one of his students, and that was Samuel Smith. Well, Sam Smith looked through all of these books, found very little that inspired him until he came across God Bless Saxony. And he thought the lyrics were fascinating. He decided to rewrite them into an American tune, My Country, 'Tis of Thee. He rushed over to both Smith and Mason, showed them what he'd written. They were very impressed. And on July 4th in 1832, they used a children's choir to perform this song in Boston for the very first time and were greeted with critics who were a bit harsh, to say the least. The critics were the common people, and they wanted to know why Smith would write an American patriotic song to the much hated at that particular time, God Save the King. There was still a lot of animosity toward the British at that particular point. Well, Smith had never heard God Save the King at the time, and he did not realize it was a British tune. And he tried to explain that and finally went back and did some research. And the song had really been brought to America even before it became a British national anthem. It was brought to America as a tune called Whitefield's Tune and was used for folk music, had several different lyrics. And tracing it back, we also found that at one point or another, it was the national song for Prussia, Norway, Finland, and it was even sung by the Huns years before that. So what Smith did as he fought to prove that he had not stolen the song from Britain, he also actually showed Britain that they had stolen it from someone else. So God Save the King, or God Save the Queen as we know it today, is actually a song that didn't originate in Britain at all, and it obviously doesn't have American roots. And like many of our patriotic songs, we talked about Yankee Doodle a while ago, and we talk about this one, the roots of these songs, in a lot of cases, take place in the old world.
One of the most fascinating stories in your book is that of Yellow Rose of Texas, which is, as far as I know, a thoroughly American song, but it is, you write, one of the first widely popular American songs written by an African American.
It is, and in that respect, it's probably one of the oldest, if not the oldest song that we know written by an African American other than Negro spirituals. And the Negro spirituals were the music that we know from the African American culture, and they are so important in American music. As a matter of fact, I don't have it in this particular book, but when the African Americans were freed for the first time, freed African American slaves who were marching in Washington, D.C. on the July 4th parade in 1862, they sang the song Roll Jordan Roll. Everyone there thought it was a beautiful spiritual, had no idea they were singing it because it was a code song. When someone was going to escape on the Underground Railroad, the slaves in the field sang that song because Jordan represented the Ohio River and heaven represented the freedom that was found on the other side of the Ohio River. And so the history of African American music is absolutely fascinating. And this particular song that no one really relates now, they relate the rose as a yellow flower. The Yellow Rose of Texas was a woman, probably her name was Emily West Morgan. As a matter of fact, the original name of Yellow Rose of Texas was probably Emily the Maid of Morgan's Point. We know the initials of the songwriter were J.K. We don't know his name. He was probably a slave from Tennessee who had moved to Texas when his owner had moved to Texas. He fell in love, as did many people, with this beautiful mulatto who had come from New York with the Morgan family. She was probably from the Caribbean. And because she was a mulatto, her skin had a different color than most of the slaves in that area. And in the bright sunlight, it shone almost yellow. And hence, Emily West Morgan was the Yellow Rose of Texas. The song was written about her. Now, she is a legend in Texas because this is a woman who was given her freedom because of her part in the Texas War for Independence against Mexico. Supposedly, this beautiful woman occupied Santa Ana and kept him so occupied he was unaware of the Texas troops gathering to defeat him in the Battle of San Jacinto. And so this particular woman was known as that. Now, isn't it ironic that within 20 years, the real story of the Yellow Rose of Texas had been forgotten, and it was used, ironically enough, by the Confederates as a campfire song and a marching song during the Civil War. And so here's a song written by an African-American, about an African-American, and it became a standard of the South in the Civil War. Of course, after the Civil War, it was taken around the world and really is one of the few patriotic songs that it has any age on it whatsoever, and historic patriotic song that's ever been on the hit parade. And, of course, Mitch Miller put the Yellow Rose of Texas on the hit parade in the 1950s.
What sort of thing happens again and again in your book? A song will be written, its origins end up being forgotten over time. In a very different way, This Land Is Your Land is sort of like that. It's written by a man with communist leanings, and yet the school children who've been singing it since, well, 1950s and 60s and on, hardly imagine that that's what they're talking about.
Yeah, This Land Is Your Land. Woody Guthrie, of course, Guthrie now is known kind of as this American icon, this folk hero. Yet Guthrie, born in 1912 in Oklahoma, grew up in abject poverty. His life was visited by many things that were negative as a youth, including losing his mother to Huntington's disease. Became a folk singer. Traveled throughout America during the Depression, you know, finding work wherever he could find work, and then seeing all of the heartache and the suffering. And I have a firsthand knowledge of this because my father was on one of those trucks that went from Arkansas to California to pick fruit when he was a very small child. So I've heard the stories. My family, I guess, lived the grapes of wrath. And that's what Guthrie was living as well. And because of all the poverty he saw, because of all the hopelessness he saw, he gave up on the American dream. And when he gave up on the American dream, he literally joined the Communist Party. He became an important part of voicing its message through songs, particularly on a station in Mexico that beamed music throughout the United States. By 1940, he had drifted to New York and became a very important part of the folk music movement in New York. And the song he learned to hate was God Bless America, the Irving Berlin song that was so popular, because he heard it over and over again on jukeboxes everywhere. And he felt that this did not really represent America. He thought America was a place of hopelessness, a place where the rich were rich and the poor were poor, and there was a dividing wall that the poor could never cross into that area of not wanting and not needing. And so he wrote the song This Land Is Your Land as a satire, really, and it was a parody song. And the line that we sing now, it's the last line of the song is, "This land was made for you and me." But he didn't write it that way in 1940. He wrote it in kind of a mocking tone, "God bless America for me." In other words, he was saying, "Hey, there's no blessings here. There's nothing. You know, this land may be your land. It's not my land. And if it's my land, why don't you share some of it with me?" And so there was that kind of tone. It was set to an A.P. Carter tune, but it was never recorded until after World War II ended for Woody Guthrie. Woody Guthrie was in the Merchant Marine in World War II. Came back with a different perspective, took the tone, "God bless America for me," that mocking tone, turned it into the words we talked about, "This land was made for you and me," began to see that there was some hope for the nation. And Woody Guthrie didn't suddenly become this middle-of-the-road American. He kept his left leanings throughout his life. He still embraced the Communist Party. He still embraced some rather revolutionary ideas. But after watching America pull together and fight during World War II, he also recognized that there was a lot about this country that was very, very good. Yet I think a lot of the people who sing "This Land Is Your Land" might have second thoughts about it if they realized it had been written by a communist as a satire on the fact that the American dream did not exist for most people.
Your book is just filled with all sorts of unlikely people. I absolutely did not expect to read about the opera composer Jacques Offenbach when you were discussing the Marine hymn.
Yeah, well, I didn't expect to find that either when we were going back and doing the research on that. And here's the irony here. Offenbach was a German who wrote in French. He came to France. He wrote operas there in France. And he wrote one particular opera that premiered in the United States in 1868. And in that was a tune that sounds very, very much like the Marine's hymn. Now, here is where it all gets kind of wishy-washy, because most people believe the Marine's hymn was written by a Marine who was involved in the war with Mexico and was inspired probably by the Marine flag at the time, which had written on it during that time, the Marine flag, "From the Shores of Tripoli," the first great battle. And so, hence, "From the Shores of Tripoli to the Halls of Montezuma," hence Mexico down there, those two things were lionized in this particular song. Well, if those became the anchors, then you figure it had to be written during that Mexican time, and so written probably by a soldier during that time. Yet you find there was a Spanish folk song that was sung in Mexico during that time that sounded a great deal like the Offenbach piece in the opera. Well, probably Offenbach was inspired by the Spanish folk song that he heard someplace in Europe. So now think of this. The Marine's hymn, which is one of the best-known military hymns in all the world. In truth, if you travel in Europe or Australia or even Japan, people know the song, the Marine's hymn. They know who it stands for. But here is a German composer living in France who used a Spanish folk song that ultimately became the bass tune for the Marine's hymn for an American service group. Now, that's pretty convoluted, yet if you think about it, isn't that kind of what America is all about? Because America is the great, some people say, melting pot. I prefer to think of it as a great salad bowl, where people come from all over the world. They come in and they make this incredible salad with all these wonderful flavors where elements of their old culture stand out, but they blend into this dynamic culture that reflects something very, very unique in the world. So the Marine's hymn, I guess, in that respect, that it hears this old folk song based on the Spanish tune that has a little opera impact in it and influences from all over the world, it really does represent America pretty much like what we really are and what we always have been.
That raises a further point, I suppose. A lot of the songs we've talked about, whatever their origins, end up uniting people, sometimes in surprising ways. You talk about the way the North and South were united in the Civil War over music, for example. But I'm interested in more recent music. The most recent songs that you include in your book, things like Ballad of the Green Beret, Abraham, Martin, and John, Merle Haggard's Fight Inside of Me, I wonder if they have quite that same quality. Are more recent patriotic songs as likely to divide us as unite us?
I think you're probably right in that respect, because I think when we sing those songs, we actually are in a point where it is divisive, because you're lining up on one side or the other on an issue that is important in history right now. You're either for or against the war in Iraq. You're either for or against various parts of social structure in the United States that are changing right now. But as time passes, and the reasons those songs were written pass as well, hence "This Land Is Your Land" is a classic example, the song takes on a different meaning. It's no longer a divisive element. It's a part of the fabric, a part of the quilt that is America. And suddenly, once those divisions of history that are at this moment covered by time, the songs lose their divisive nature and become important to all Americans. A classic example of that would be Julia Ward's How Battle Hymn of the Republic, which was definitely a Union fight song during the Civil War, which is now one of the most revered hymns, patriotic hymns in the American culture. And yet this was a song that obviously would not have been performed or sung in the South probably for 20, 30, 40 years after the Civil War.
Well, Mr. Collins, thanks so much for talking with us.
You bet.
It's been fascinating. I've been speaking with Ace Collins, the author of Song Sung, Red, White, and Blue, the stories behind America's best-loved patriotic songs.
Been much talk lately about what some are calling the American Empire. Some resent the implications of such a title. Others deny that an American Empire even exists. But as Alan Winkler explains in our commentary of the week, Americans have thought about empire for a long time. Winkler, no stranger to talking history, is a professor of history at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. He's also the author of The Cold War, published by Oxford University Press.
As I was driving in my car the other day, I found myself listening to a Phil Oakes folk song from the 1960s. The radical singer was in the forefront of the anti-war movement, and some of his songs dealt with Vietnam. Cops of the World was a larger critique of American policy that is still pertinent today. The ill-advised, ill-planned, and ill-executed foray into Iraq is sufficient evidence that the United States still thinks of itself in imperial terms and still believes it can do anything it wants in the world. "We pick and choose as we please," Phil Oakes sang, as he referred to the American arrogance that got us into such trouble in Vietnam. And now, with the horrors of Abu Ghraib still in the forefront of our minds, we're at it again. Americans have thought about empire for a long time. The Manifest Destiny movement of the mid-19th century envisioned an empire stretching from shore to shore. The American victory in the Spanish-American War of 1898 opened the way to taking over the Philippines and becoming an imperial power able to compete with the Europeans, who had already parceled out much of the world. But the American position had a prime exponent in the mid-20th century during World War II. Publisher Henry Luce, whose own print empire included both Time and Life magazines, believed in the face of the fascist threat that the United States had to accept that its reach was now global. In an editorial in the February 7, 1941 issue of Life, Luce proclaimed that the American century had already begun. And with victory in the Second World War, and later in the Cold War, that belief has persisted. Not all Americans agreed. Henry Wallace, Franklin Roosevelt's vice president in the early 1940s, countered by arguing that this needed to be the century of the common man, but more people agreed with Luce than Wallace. Yet American might won't last forever, and there are even times, remember the war in Vietnam, when this nation's ferocious military machine has faltered. Nor do empires last forever. A decade and a half ago, historian Paul Kennedy, in The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, Economic Change and Military Conflict from 1500 to 2000, wrote about powerful empires and concluded that the spiral of increasing economic might and military power couldn't last forever. No empire in the past remains intact today, and it's not likely that ours will either. The United States has behaved with unbelievable arrogance in its preemptive strike on Iraq. The latest disclosures about the sad state of American and British intelligence make clear the bankruptcy of our political position, no matter how evil Saddam Hussein may have been. But the attack didn't come in a vacuum. It resulted from the overarching sense that the United States could do anything, regardless of the reaction of others. Back in the 1950s, authors Eugene Burdick and William Lederer wrote a book called The Ugly American. It was about the ineptitude of American diplomacy and the arrogance that made others around the globe wonder about American values. The Peace Corps, begun in the early 1960s, was an effort to do something about that sorry state of affairs. We lost sight of that alternative approach in Vietnam, and we've lost sight of it again in Iraq. Instead, we're back to being what Phil Oakes called the cops of the world, but the consequences may well be as serious as they were in Vietnam.
You've been listening to Alan Winkler, professor of history at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. Next up, Fiona Beattie's Site of the Week. You're listening to Talking History.
Come get out of the way, boys. Quick, get out of the way. You'd better watch what you say, boy. Better watch what you say. We've rammed in your harbor and tied to your port, and our pistols are hungry and our tempers are short. So bring your daughters around to the fort. 'Cause we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world.
The so-called Midnight Ride of Paul Revere has long been the subject of literary and artistic fancy, to the point where many of us are no longer able to separate fact from fiction. Here to tell you about a new exhibit that looks at both is Talking History's Fiona Beattie.
Paul Revere, that icon of American heroism and patriotism, deserves closer examination. Enchanting as it is, Longfellow's poem, Paul Revere's Ride, departs from the truth in flights of poetical fancy, and it is important to set the record straight. The Brandywine River Museum does just that by presenting a refreshing examination of Paul Revere, his myth and legend, in an exhibition titled Revere's Ride and Longfellow's Legend. That legend has also inspired the artistic lens, and the exhibit features a wide selection of art from Romanticism to Realism, and parody. There's even a comedy strip by Charles Schulz. Yep, Linus and Snoopy. Paul Revere played an important role in American history, and the exhibition allows the visitor to explore just how essential that role really was, all myth and legend aside. Paul Revere's Ride and Longfellow's Legend remains on exhibit through November the 21st at the Brandywine River Museum, Chatsworth, Pennsylvania. It will then travel to the National Heritage Museum in Lexington, Massachusetts, where it will open January the 29th for 6 months. For more information, go to www.brandywinemuseum.org.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. As usual, we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that our producer is Fiona Beattie, and that our studio engineer is Alex Smith, and that the opinions offered by our guests on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And finally, we invite you to send us your comments on this show by email, if you wish, to talkinghistory@umkc.edu, or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.